Lecture 15, Engineering the Fall of Athens.
Welcome back. That Peace of Callias, concluded in 449 BC between the Athenian Maritime Empire on the one hand and the great Empire of Persia on the other, was to last 37 years. That may not seem very long, but since there'd been 50 years of continuous fighting beforehand, from 499 BC when the Ionian Revolt broke out, all the way down to that final conclusion of peace, that 37 years looked pretty good. But during that time, even though Athens and Persia were nominally agreeing to stop their hostilities and to agree to mutually exclusive spheres of influence, there were certainly elements of conflict that gave it the feeling of a Cold War. When the island of Samos, which was a major player in the Athenian Empire, one of the Ionian states that they had brought in first as an ally and then much more as a subject, when the island of Samos revolted from Athens, it was clear that the great king was planning to help with the revolt in defiance of the terms of the peace. On the other hand, when one of the great king's officials in Asia Minor rebelled against the great king, the Athenians gave support. And finally, when the Peloponnesian War broke out in 431 BC between Athens and Sparta, that terrible Greek against Greek war that inspired Herodotus to write his history of the Persian Wars and remind the Greeks of his own time, these warring Athenians and Spartans, that they were filling their world with calamities that didn't need to happen, that they should unite again with a common purpose as they had once done against the Persians. Even during that Peloponnesian War, the Athenians managed to intercept a messenger who was coming from the great king, Artaxerxes, to the Spartans and discover that the messages that the fellow was carrying were a letter from the great king saying to the Spartans, "I don't understand you. You keep sending me envoys and ambassadors. Every single one of them carries a different message. What do you want?" Well, it's not clear what the Spartans wanted. They certainly wanted the fall of Athens and they wanted Persian help to do it, but they were aware that Persian help always came with strings attached and they just couldn't seem to make up their minds. At any rate, this made it clear to the Athenians that although they were formally or informally at peace with Persia, the Persians were still to be feared as an element in their lives. Now, after the first 10 years of the Peloponnesian War, a peace with Sparta was concluded in 421 BC. Athens seems to have come very well out of that first 10 years of the Peloponnesian War. And then, like madmen, the Athenians allowed themselves to be goaded by one young Hellion named Alcibiades into embarking upon a distant expedition that they didn't need to undertake, an attempt to destroy the great western city of Syracuse in Sicily, and ultimately take over the whole island of Sicily, a great source of grain, rich Greek colonial cities, large populations. They would bring Sicily into their empire. There were certain Athenians who dreamed of ruling the Mediterranean, as the great king ruled over Persia and the lands from the Himalayas all the way to Thrace. They thought that they could turn the Mediterranean into an Athenian lake. Once they had conquered Sicily, if they could just knock off the Carthaginians in North Africa and the Etruscans in Italy, it would all be theirs. So they were very receptive in about the year 416 BC, 5 years after they had fought Sparta to a standstill, when this young Alcibiades came forward in the assembly and urged the Athenians to undertake this expedition to Syracuse. They had a few trumped-up excuses and pretexts for attacking this fellow democracy among Greek cities, and the desire to become even richer than they were now spurred them to vote in favor of this big expedition going west to Sicily. Our course is about the Greeks and the Persians, not about Greeks versus Greeks, so we will not follow them in detail. But suffice it to say that this expedition ended in tragedy for all concerned. Alcibiades, this brilliant young Athenian commander and politician, brave as a lion, cunning as Odysseus, charismatic in a way that very few Athenian leaders had ever been. He was the ward of Pericles, the architect of the Athenian Golden Age, and he'd been brought up almost like a young prince in Athens, ready to take over the position as first citizen of the city. He was found guilty by his fellow citizens of various crimes and exiled and fled away to Sparta and took refuge there with Athens' enemies and was so bitter about his treatment from his fellow citizens that he worked tirelessly through the years of the Sicilian expedition to ruin Athens, to give the Spartans advice that would allow them to help the Syracusans defend themselves against the Athenians and ultimately defeat the Athenians, and also to tell the Spartans, get up there in Attica, plant yourself a fort right outside Athens and lay siege to the city. The Spartans did that, and that was a terrific blow against Athenian independence and the prospects for the future. So Alcibiades had now become an evil genius working against his home city from outside. It all came to a head in the year 413 BC, when after three campaigning seasons in Sicily, the whole thing ended in total disaster in the great harbor of Syracuse. The Athenians were trapped with their fleet and their men inside the great harbor. The Syracusans destroyed them. More than 160 triremes were lost. Thousands of men were killed or imprisoned. And that was the end of the Syracusan expedition. How did the Athenians hear about the disaster? Well, the word was spreading through the Mediterranean, but there was no Athenian who survived, alive or free, to carry the message home to Athens. So a long time went by with the Athenians in the happy illusion that they were still winning in Sicily when a stray mariner brought his ship into the Piraeus, walked into a barber shop for a shave and a haircut, and sitting there in the chair, said to the barber, terrible thing what happened to you Athenians in Sicily. And the barber said, what do you mean? And the man told him of the great defeat, and the barber ran all the way, the 4.5 miles, up to Athens to tell the archons of the city what had happened. At that point, as the news spread that Athens had been defeated there, Athens' enemies and rivals everywhere joined together to destroy this great Golden Age city that had brought so many wonderful creative things into the world, but which had brought this very oppressive imperialism along with them. One of the sets of people who were interested now in helping to engineer the fall of Athens were the Persians. And the two who took the lead were a couple of satraps, those provincial governors whose territories abutted the eastern side of the Athenian Empire. These were the western satrapies of what is today Turkey, Asia Minor, one led by a wily rogue named Tissaphernes, whose capital was at Sardis, and his satrapy was West Central Asia Minor, and the other was a noble Persian warrior named Pharnabazos. He ruled from a headquarters up near the Sea of Marmara, and he ruled over northwest Anatolia, northwest Asia Minor. So these two sent ambassadors, along with lots of cities and islands, to Sparta saying, come to us first. There are Athenians right here who you can fight. We occupy a great territory for launching attacks on the Athenians. We will help you. We will fund your expeditions. Let us be the staging ground for the final destruction of Athens. The Spartans weren't sure which way to turn. At this point, Alcibiades, still living at Sparta, advised the Spartans, pick Tissaphernes, cross the sea to Persia, cross the sea to Asia, and join with Tissaphernes, this satrap at Sardis, and let's defeat the Athenians there. Alcibiades had his own reasons for wanting this to happen and for getting out of Greece. Irrepressible as ever, he had managed to have a love affair with the queen of Sparta, one of the wives of one of the two kings, and had managed to get her pregnant. She was bearing his child and actually so besotted with Alcibiades that she was proud of it. And he wanted to get out before his head was on a platter. So before the word got to this king that Alcibiades had cuckolded him, Alcibiades headed off in a ship, crossed over to Asia, and met with Tissaphernes. He had finally met someone as wily, as unreliable, as deceitful as himself, and the two got along like a house on fire. And Alcibiades negotiated a sort of meeting between Tissaphernes, this powerful Persian noble, this satrap, and the Spartans who followed Alcibiades over. And in a disgraceful meeting, the Spartans agreed to sign away the freedom of all the Greeks in Asia, that freedom whose existence had actually triggered the whole Greek and Persian wars to begin with. The Spartans were willing to sign them over, lock, stock, and barrel, to the great king, if only the Persians would provide the the Spartans with enough help, especially enough money, to successfully wage a war against Athens. So that was the final agreement that was concluded. Alcibiades thought that that would be the end of it, but out of nowhere, the Athenians showed up. As Thucydides, who's the historian and chronicler of this period, says, democracies are always at their best in a crisis. Well, after the great defeat in the harbor at Syracuse in Sicily, the Athenians were at the supreme crisis of their history, and they rallied. They took extreme measures to control the hemorrhaging of money out of their treasury. They appointed 10 counselors to sort of review all the proposals to limit the democracy and the power of the assembly to vote anything. They basically governed through a series of referendums on every single issue. And now with these 10 counselors in place, there was a sort of a check on the power of the people, a balance to the impulses of the assembly to go one way and the other. One of these counselors is a man that we should pause and look at for a moment. He's the famous tragic playwright Sophocles, whose most famous play today is Oedipus Rex. He was the most respected Athenian. He had actually served for a time as a naval commander during that rebellion of Samos. He had been a treasurer of the Athenian Empire, and now he was appointed counselor. He was a very old man by this time. His memory went all the way back to the Battle of Salamis, where he'd been a 17-year-old, handsomest boy in Athens, and he had been chosen to lead the victory dance for the Battle of Salamis all those years ago. Now he found Athens at the nadir of its fortunes and was among those old men working to pull the city up by its bootstraps. So successful was this new regime that within a few months they had put together an Athenian fleet, they'd bought timber from the northern kingdom of Macedon, they'd built new ships, they'd conscripted everybody into the fleet again, just as they had done at Salamis, and sent them across to the island of Samos, using that as a base to attack the Spartans and Persians on Asia Minor, taking the offensive. So there was a battle outside Ephesus. Alcibiades was with the Persian and Spartan side and had the mortification of seeing them, the Spartans, beaten on land by an Athenian expeditionary force. And at this point, he said to himself, these Spartans are losers. I'm fighting with the wrong side. So he went up to Sardis, and he ingratiated himself with the Persians there, with Tissaphernes, with all these nobles of the court. It was a very different life from what he'd been experiencing in Sparta, with the mess tents, and the black broth, and the hard bread, and the living tough, and talking short, and pretending to like Spartan ways. Now it was all cushions, gourmet food, perfumes, delicate music, and court intrigues. Alcibiades, like a chameleon, managed to fit in there just as well as he'd fitted in at Sparta, and he soon became Tissaphernes, the satrap's best friend. And he said something to Tissaphernes that became a thread of Persian policy toward the Greeks for the next 80 years. Don't arrange for one side to beat the other. Help them both. Keep them both just healthy enough that they can batter away Athens against Sparta and ultimately weaken each other so you, the Persians, will always be the stronger of the three. Well, this was very pleasing advice to Tissaphernes. He liked nothing better than double dealing and double crossing. So under the pretense of still helping the Spartans and holding up his end of that agreement that if the Persians would give Spartans help, the Spartans would turn over the Greek cities of Ionia and of Asia back to the king, once the war was over and Athens was defeated, Tissaphernes was in fact continually undercutting the war effort for the Spartans, and the Spartans became gradually aware of this. Now, after a couple of years of this, in 411 BC, an amazing thing happened. The Athenian fleet was still stationed on the island of Samos. I mean, you can swim across from Samos to Mount Mycale on the Asiatic mainland. So they were right there near the sort of a heartbeat of all of this intrigue and diplomacy. They were aware that Alcibiades was up at Sardis, and many of the common men, the democratic men in the Athenian fleet, longed for Alcibiades. They'd always liked him. They thought he was given a raw deal when he was exiled, and they sent a messenger to Sardis inviting Alcibiades to come and lead not the city of Athens, but the fleet, which was becoming a breakaway power of its own. He wanted nothing more than to get back to Athens. He was fed up with Spartans. He was fed up with Persians. He wanted to take his kinsman Pericles' place as the leader of his natal city, and so he agreed, and he went down to Samos and became one of the generals of the fleet, now restored to Athens. How many reverses can one have in a 4 or 5 year period? Alcibiades went through all of them. At this point, the Spartans, in disgust, remembered that that good, noble, reliable Persian up by the Hellespont, Pharnabazos, had also offered to collaborate with the Spartans in destroying Athens. And so they gave up on Ionia, they gave up on Ephesus and Samos and that whole theater of war, and putting all of their troops into their triremes, they made a dash for the north and the Hellespont. Now, we've been to the Hellespont before. You remember it's that channel of water that leads the waters from the Black Sea down into the Aegean. It's the place where Xerxes spanned the straits with those pontoon bridges that allowed his grand army in the spring of 480 BC to cross over into Greece. And it was the place where the Athenians had gone and recaptured the Hellespont and took those cables of the bridges and carried them back home. The Hellespont was the lifeline of Athens. We've talked a little bit before about how this is a time of global economy. Athens depended, even for its basic commodities like wheat and fish, on imports from great distances. And the Black Sea was one of the key areas of Athenian control. In fact, they had managed to add it to their empire in the 420s. And Black Sea cities appear on the tribute list that were inscribed in stone on the Athenian Acropolis. It was a terrifying thing for the Athenians to learn that there were Spartans now in the Hellespont. Most of the grain that kept Athenians alive and gave them their daily bread came through that narrow pass, that channel of water, coming down in the great annual grain fleets of harvests of grain from the Black Sea area, from the Crimea, from the Ukraine. Athens depended for its existence on those ships. And finally, the Spartans had put two and two together and realized if we can grab those straits, we can starve Athens to submission without ever going anywhere near the city. Pharnabazos, the noble and reliable and honorable Persian who led the king's forces up there along the Hellespont, the Sea of Marmara, the Bosphorus, he proved to be a completely different kettle of fish from Tissaphernes, his colleague to the south. He not only helped the Spartans, he actually joined them in the battles that succeeded this move as the Athenians chased after the Spartans going up to the north, entrenched themselves in the Hellespont also, and clashed twice with the Spartan fleet in the stream of the Hellespont. Very difficult naval battles where the water is sweeping you down all the time like the current of a river, and you're trying to maintain place and keep battering away at the enemy in the straits. At any rate, both of these battles resulted in victories for the Athenians, completely unexpected for all concerned. But in the second battle, called the Battle of Abydos, named after the town on the south side of the Hellespont where Xerxes had anchored his bridges, Pharnabazos was so fired up by the sight of these Athenian ships charging down on the Spartans fleeing to shore, that he got on his horse, rallied his Persian cavalry, and they charged into the water to try to fight the Athenians. Lances of the Persians sort of threatening these Athenian ships as they came in, hoping to save the Spartans, hoping to turn the tide of the battle. A very impetuous man, Pharnabazos, a very heroic one. But in spite of all of his efforts, they lost that battle. He agreed, however, to keep funding the Spartan effort over the winter, paying them for that one essential thing that Sparta couldn't afford, because Sparta had no treasury. Sparta had no empire. Sparta didn't even really have money. They were a sort of honor society of militaristic folk who were called upon by all and sundry for help, but didn't build up great wealth themselves. How could they have a navy? Only if Persia would pay for the rowers, those hundreds, those thousands of skilled oarsmen who were needed in these galleys. Pharnabazos says, I will keep paying you, and I will provide you a place to spend the winter. He went back to his capital, a place called Daskylion, just south of the Sea of Marmara, and he entrenched himself there with his cavalry by a big lake, and then he built a fort for mercenaries that he paid for, Persian mercenaries, to be on the coast, and right there by the mercenary fort, there was a city that the Spartans took over, a former city of the Athenian Empire called Cyzicus. And at this base, the Spartans kept their fleet over the winter and trained their oarsmen that were paid for by Pharnabazos the Persian, waiting for spring. Alcibiades and his fellow Athenian generals learned that the Spartans had taken Cyzicus, and they decided they were going to get it back. And they were also going to try to ruin the Spartan naval effort at sea and discredit the Spartans with the Persians, so the Persians would stop paying the Spartans, would lose their feeling of confidence in the Spartans to destroy Athens. So, under cover of darkness, the Athenians went from the mouth of the Hellespont, from Sestos, in their ships, slipping past all the Spartan guard posts in the night so that there would be no word of their coming as they went up the channel and approached Cyzicus. They would row during the night, they would sleep on shore, hidden during the day. Nobody knew they were coming. They spent the last night of their approach on an island in the middle of the Sea of Marmara, and Alcibiades called the men together, these Athenians, and he said, "We have no money left. We have nothing to support ourselves. If you want to feed yourselves, and if you want to go beyond that and be rich and free, you are going to have to fight on the sea. You're going to have to fight on land. You're going to have to take walled cities. You're going to have to win your way back to prosperity and victory. Are you with me?" Well, of course, they were all with him. It was a very exciting moment, and he was always a great one for rousing the spirits of the men. So that evening, they got into their ships, and they headed south towards Cyzicus, the place where the Spartans had holed up right under that great fort of the Persian mercenaries and not too far from Pharnabazos' headquarters with his Persian cavalry. At this point, Spartans and Persians alike had begun to discount the Athenian effort. The Athenians had not been much in evidence during the winter. It seemed very likely that they had just sort of split up and gone away. And instead, they were right there, headed down in the darkness. And their plan of approaching without being caught was very much favored by a heavy shower of rain that came down. So all the Spartan scouts on the coast went into their little huts and shelters, and the Athenian fleet approached with no one knowing they were there. The Athenians first came into shore in the hours before dawn and put an army on shore on the coast north of Cyzicus with orders to go up to the city wall and be ready to attack the city on the land side as the fleet attacked the city harbor at Cyzicus. And then they put into effect the last part of their plan. Alcibiades had spent his youth, or a couple of years of his youth, campaigning in northern Greece with a great Athenian general named Phormio, the greatest strategist and tactician the Athenians ever produced after Themistocles. And Phormio had taught Alcibiades and anybody else who was with him how you draw an enemy away from a strong position. It's like the bird and the snake. You put a tempting little morsel in front of the enemy that they can't resist chasing after. And once they've left their secure position or broken up their fine formation, that's when you hit them. Alcibiades volunteered to be the bird. He took a small force of Athenian triremes. He rode forward, burst out of the curtain of rain. There was the sunshine, and there in the sunshine was the whole Spartan fleet out on the water doing their morning exercises. They caught sight of Alcibiades and his little expeditionary force, assuming that this was a group of unwitting Athenians who foolishly had appeared, thinking Cyzicus was still a friendly city, not aware that the Spartans were there in force. They immediately stopped their exercising and set off after Alcibiades and his little squadron in dead earnest. They chased them away across the Sea of Marmara, and as they left Cyzicus harbor undefended, the main body of the Athenians moved into position and waited for Alcibiades to come back and join them in taking the city. But Alcibiades, unreliable as always, had gone sort of crazy out there on the water. As he turned and faced the Spartans who were chasing him, and they looked back and saw they were now between two fires, two Athenian fleets, the Spartans went for the mainland, and Alcibiades, who should have at this point rejoined his fellows, chased after them, chased them to the shore, actually landed his few marines formed up as if he had an army behind him with just, in fact, a few hundred Athenian marines, and attacked the Spartan army that had come off the ships. Well, he was as brave as a lion, but he didn't always have a lot of sense. But this time, his impetuosity paid off. His colleagues, his fellow Athenian generals, saw across the water what was happening. One of them decided to go help him immediately. The other one went to fetch the army that was waiting on land for the appointed time to come over the walls. And as Theramenes, the Athenian, went off to get the army, Thrasybulus, his colleague, landed the other Athenian force at the other end of the grounded Spartan fleet, came ashore and started fighting the Spartans from that side. Meanwhile, Pharnabazos' mercenaries had seen what was going on from the fort, and they came spilling in their hundreds down the mountainside to join in the battle. Things looked bad for the Athenians when at the last possible minute, Theramenes, the third general, arrived, having picked up the troops from the city, landed them in time to turn the tide of battle. The Spartan general was killed. He was a man named Mindaros, in whom Pharnabazos had placed a lot of hope. The Spartans were routed. The Athenians chased them back to their fort. And then when they heard the Persian cavalry and Pharnabazos coming at them, they retreated back to their ships. There was scarcely as happy a set of men in ancient history as those Athenians on the day that they beat the Spartans and the Persians together at Cyzicus. And they intercepted another message right after that as the surviving Spartan leader sent word of this terrible defeat back to Sparta, asking the home folks, the ephors in Sparta, what to do. And the Athenians were amused to find this very laconic message. Our word laconic comes from Laconia, the Spartan homeland. It means to be short and terse in your speech. And this was the true telegraph kind of style of message. And it went like this. Mindaros dead, ships lost, men starving, don't know what to do. Well, they indeed did not know what to do because their failure had guaranteed that Pharnabazos lost interest in the Spartan effort. And in fact, it was only the arrival, a couple of years later, of a new element in the scene, a Persian prince named Cyrus, after his great predecessor, the conqueror Cyrus, who started the Persian Empire, sent out by his father, the great king, with orders to help the Spartans win the war. The great king finally having realized that if we can just get all those Ionian cities back, we will once again have our tribute from the Eastern Greeks. It was all about money. Prince Cyrus became the friend of a new Spartan commander, Lysander, greatest strategic genius Sparta ever produced. And between the help of Prince Cyrus paying for Lysander's cruise, Lysander once looked gloomy at a feast with Cyrus. Prince Cyrus, the Persian, said, what do you want? I'll give you anything. And Lysander said to him, I want one more obol a day for my cruise. And that was what he was thinking of, Persian gold to pay for Spartan military effort. He got the money. He put together some wonderful campaigns against Athens, caught the Athenian fleet finally in the Hellespont at a place called Goat Rivers, Egospotami, trapped them on land due to his own clever strategies, and beat the Athenians, won the Peloponnesian War, sailed to Athens, and tore down the city walls of Athens after Athens itself surrendered. So I shouldn't have said the city walls. It's those long walls, that umbilical cord that connected Athens to its port, the Piraeus, that were torn down. And showman that he was, Lysander had the pipers, the girls who played pipes at parties in Athens, come out and play tunes as the Spartan engineers dismantled the fortifications of Athens that had made it a great naval power. Well, it was all thanks to Persia, and the Persians had gotten out of this war exactly what they wanted. The Athenian Empire was broken up. The Spartans, who they didn't worry about, though they should have, now did turn the Greek cities in Asia back over to the Persians, at least temporarily. And as the long walls came crashing down, as a pro-Spartan government of 30 tyrants took over in Athens, and as that government of the 30 tyrants actually tore down the naval installations and the shipsheds and the Piraeus, the pride and glory of the Athenian fleet, the basis of Athenian power for half a century, everybody in the Greek world could have been forgiven for thinking, this, at last, is the end of Athens. But the Delphic oracle had once proclaimed Athens unsinkable, saying that it would ride forever upon the waves of the ocean. And truly, although Persian gold had brought Athens down now, by a great twist of fate and to the astonishment of all, within 10 years, the Persians themselves would raise Athens up again.